So I forgot to mention, I'm not sure if you know, I'm Laura Wagner. I'm the executive director of UU Mass Action. And for those who don't know, that's the state advocacy network in Massachusetts that coordinates and organizes UU churches around issues of social justice. In order for that to work, creating community is very important, and that's today what we're talking about. Belonging to a faith community is a critical factor in maintaining the resiliency of spirit. How do we develop community and create a sense of attunement and belonging? Often we lose our way when we consider social justice issues of our time. When we stand alone and look at the problems in the world, sometimes we find ways to make a difference, but our impact is limited and the work can begin to feel overwhelming. I often feel this way myself. The nightly news tells the story of the dysfunction of Congress and shows images of endless violence and suffering in the world. This is followed by images of children suffering under the cruel conditions of poverty, and then the plea comes on to help the abused dogs with that song by Melissa Etheridge, and that's when I feel completely overwhelmed. There's just too much work to do. What happens when we feel overwhelmed? Sometimes we get angry. When anger is combined with a sense of powerlessness, it turns into despair. When we feel despair, we tend to turn away from our community and isolate ourselves. We become numb, apathetic, and see the world as hopeless. How does one solve an issue as big as climate change, a war, a world hunger? We start by caring about those who live among us, by seeing our neighbors, really seeing them, and understanding the struggle that's right here in our own community. We start by envisioning the world we want to live in and then work towards making it happen. The Talmud teaches us, when a sorrow is shared, it is halved, and when a joy is shared, it is doubled. When a sorrow is shared, it is halved, and when a joy is shared, it is doubled. Stories that demonstrate this can deeply touch our hearts. When we learn what is possible from one another, we can learn what is possible from one another and see the world as it should be. In the fall of 2005, Reverend Bill Sinkford, who was the president of the UUA at that time, visited a community called Gosbita in eastern Chad. Chad lies less than 100 miles south of the Sahara Desert. And there he met with the Sultan Said Ibrahim da Silla. Chad is among the poorest nations on earth. The two men sat together on plastic lawn chairs and drank tea served with broken crackers. The crackers were not a sign of disrespect, but rather how impoverished the people of Gosbita are. Reverend Sinkford and the Sultan began to speak about the devastation inflicted on the fur people by the continuing genocide. At the time that the article was written, an estimated 200,000 people had streamed across the border seeking refuge in the impoverished nation of Chad. 15,000 of these displaced, traumatized people sought refuge in the community of Gosbita. What do you think happened? How do you think the community of Gosbita responded to these refugees? I invite you to stop for a moment right now and think about what that might have felt like. Imagine yourself in that community, very little resources, extreme poverty, and 15,000 people come to your community seeking help. What would that feel like? Just stop for a minute and let that settle in your body. What the people did is they opened their granaries. The granaries were all that stood between the people of Gosbita and starvation. When Reverend Sinkford asked how they came to make such a decision, the Sultan simply said it was the right thing to do. He said, "When you are comfortable in your own house, but your neighbor is not, then you will not know peace." It is said that the prophet speaks two languages, one of despair and one of hope. This story captures that prophetic voice. It tells the story of deep suffering and despair, but also hope for what our world could look like. The story of the people of Gazbita makes me feel angry when I think about our country's response to the 60,000 unaccompanied youth who arrived at our border during the recently passed summer months. These children were fleeing the violence that was created in large part by U.S. economic policies and what we call the war on drugs. These children were and are refugees deserving of asylum. This was a human rights crisis. And how did we respond? I'd like you to stop for a moment again and move from your head to your heart. I know there may be differing opinions in this room for how we should respond to the migrants who come to this country. But it's so important to move from an intellectual understanding of a situation to really seeing the people involved, feeling, putting yourself in the shoes of the person who is in need. Think for what it would feel like to be threatened by violence in your community, to see the people you love be killed and murdered and know that it's going to continue unless you leave. Or if you have no food and no food to give your children, what would you do? Would you leave your home? Would you take a perilous journey because of a glimmer of hope that things might be better somewhere else? I know I would, even if it meant violating immigration law to get to that someplace else. I know we have communities right here in the U.S. drowning in violence. We have people here who are hungry and have few options to change their circumstance. But this isn't an either-or scenario. When we view the suffering of others through the paradigm of who is deserving and who is not, we lose our way. Our UU principles remind us of the worth and dignity of all people. The words of Sultan Sayyid Ibrahim Da Silva come back to me. When you're comfortable in your own house, but your neighbor is not, then you will not know peace. I believe that we should open our granaries to all who are in need. How does it feel when I say this? Does it create a feeling of panic or anger? Do you think about why should we help people from other lands when there's so much work to do in our own backyard? Some people responded in this manner to the crisis of the unaccompanied youth this past summer. There was a lot of anger and a lot of hateful speech said, and that was definitely countered. UUs really stood and answered the call, and there was also some wonderful support outpouring, and I look forward to speaking to you and learning more about what you've been involved with here. But there was that angry voice that got a lot of attention. When that happens, it appears that the response comes from a place of anger, but really underneath that anger is fear. Fear of the stranger, fear of not having enough. When we act from a place of fear, all we see are unsolvable problems. We become numb and do nothing, or we panic and respond with anger. Our brain actually functions differently when we're overwhelmed by fear and anger. In my work with trauma survivors, we begin to learn how to regain a relaxed body. In addition to my work at UMass Action, I'm a clinical social worker, and my focus is trauma. By achieving that relaxed body, the skill helps one move from being dominated by what's called the sympathetic nervous system, which engages our fight or flight response, over to the parasympathetic nervous system, which allows one to relax. In this relaxed state, one has the ability to engage the prefrontal cortex, or the thinking part of the brain. A person dominated by fear sees very few options before them. As one learns to reach a relaxed state and let go of that fear, the possibilities increase and become clearer. What happens when we turn away from fear and instead act from a place of love? What I see happen is that a person begins to feel compassion again. A person sees possibilities and is motivated to care for their neighbor. Think about this in terms of what happens in congregations. Congregations are communities. Some, and this might be something that you haven't dealt with here, but some struggle with growth, believe it or not. And you might think about it as a community comes together and there becomes a sense of this is how things work here. Each time you add a new person, there's a change that occurs. And sometimes, as more people come, it changes things so much that it becomes an interesting issue for a congregation. Is there a point when you could have too many members? I mean, think about that here. Is there a point where too many people would be here and it would make RE difficult, and would you have to have two services, and where would people park? When you're thinking about that in terms of the faceless concept, you don't know who these people are, and we need to just stop where we are and not add any more people, it's easier to do that and to get into this place of isolation and exclusion. It's a lot different when you turn to the person next to you and say, we don't have room for you here. It feels completely different. I bring this up because it's important to think of these issues that we're talking about, the justice issues. UMass Action focuses on economic justice, and it's wonderful that you're having that forum here, and immigration, and ending mass incarceration, and environmental justice, climate change. When it doesn't involve real people, it's easy to either not see it as an issue or to just let it go or have very fixed ideas about it. It's a lot different when you sit down with a person who has crossed the border, who tells you their story and it becomes real, or tells you the story of wage theft and what it's like to be here as an undocumented person in this country, or a person who's been incarcerated, or really sit and talk to someone whose life has changed because of climate change, or the economic struggle that happens because of systemic issues and not because of a person's own deeds or actions. I offer this analogy about growth in a congregation and trying to compare those two because it demonstrates the struggle that is at the result of the challenges of immigration. We are struggling with the impact of change. In all these issues, if there's an element of change that we struggle with. And as we work in coalition together, it's most effective when the coalition grows, and these can come up too. You have ways of working together with people. You bring in new people into the mix, and the way we accomplish our goals can change. The strength or weakness of a group is determined by how new voices are invited in, whether it's to a congregation, to a coalition that works together, a congregation, a community, or a country. It's important to remember that communities are living, growing entities that are ever changing and evolving. As that community evolves and grows, it can be challenging to explore and pursue new ideas while remaining true to our core values. Putting our faith into action and trying to address social justice can be challenging at times. I have witnessed a person feeling overwhelmed by the enormity of social justice issues many times. In the last year or so, many congregations read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Has that been a book that you've explored here? It details just an overwhelmingly broken, we could argue broken system. It's working for some. My home congregation of Northborough read this book, which is about the driving factors of mass incarceration. After reading it, one of the members came to me with a distressed look on his face and said, how do we even start? The problem is so big. We start by first coming together and educating ourselves about what's happening in our local area. This isn't a problem that's happening out there. All these things, immigration, everything brings back to it's right here. Once we educate ourselves, we reach out to that community that is made up of and led by, in the case of ending mass incarceration, we reached out to people who were formerly incarcerated and found a group in Worcester called Ex-Prisoners and Prisoners Organizing for Community Advancement, or EPICA. This is a place that provides community for people who are formerly incarcerated, and it helps them build connections so that they can feel human again. They move from being outside of the circle of humanity to feeling included and valued. We went to EPICA's office first to learn about what is important to them, and then we collaborated on how we could work together and share the same goals. It brings back the story of the geese. As these issues come up, one congregation could try to figure out what should we do, how should we solve this, and work in isolation, but you're that lone goose. There's only so much you can do. When you join together with others, you first look around, who else is going in the same direction as we are? Remember, the flock can travel 71% farther when they do the job together. And this is where UU Mass Action can serve a valuable role. One congregation working for change is limited in what they can accomplish. But when many congregations from all over the state come together and organize, their power increases tenfold. We become like many droplets of water forming that ocean wave. As we work together and gain momentum, we harness tremendous energy and we become a powerful agent of change. UU Mass Action was born out of a desire to move away from isolation and instead make connections with others who share the same vision and are working on the same issues. This model makes room for everyone. The congregation that runs a food pantry or serves a community meal fills a real need. Some people prefer direct service while others seek systemic change. Multiple approaches only makes us stronger. That direct service adds that human connection and helps us to understand what exactly is happening on a deeper issue, a deeper level. As community engages in that important work of direct service, one might begin to ask, why are there so many hungry people in my community? Why is it so hard to get a job? Why is housing such an issue? And this is when we start to look at systems and policy. Maybe new legislation is made to make changes. The legislative cycle in Massachusetts spans over 2 years. Change doesn't happen by writing a bill and waiting for 2 years and hoping it passes into law. We make change by first finding an ally in the State House to sponsor the bill and then finding co-sponsors. We educate legislative members while we educate and organize ourselves. In order to be effective, many people are required to advocate for this issue. There's been a group of volunteers all through last year and beginning again this year that every month would host a lunch at the State House and invite legislators to come in and learn about mass incarceration. And there'd be speakers and information, and it started to build community, and there we've gained a lot more traction in really understanding the legislative bills that need to pass. But the work continues. UU Mass Action and our community partners organized several advocacy days throughout the year. Last year, a person asked me, why should I come to Advocacy Day? I can go to the State House anytime I want to. That's true. But time and time again, anyone who's ever worked on getting a bill passed has seen that numbers matter. One person is politely listened to. We are 20,000 UUs in Massachusetts. When we joined forces to come together and then join forces with other faith and community organizations and show up together in numbers, we become a movement and a force to be reckoned with. We have infinitely more power than one voice, no matter how passionate that voice is. Working together also allows us to be strategic. Newly introduced bills have to pass through committees, and advocates are needed to talk to committee members in order to help them understand why the bill is important. A statewide network is needed to make this happen. And UU Mass Action has served a critical role in making these connections. An example can be found in the Trust Act. The Trust Act is a piece of pro-immigration legislation that we tried to get passed, that we're continuing to work on, that helped disconnect secure what's called the ICE holds. I can explain more about this afterwards, but ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is a federal organization that will ask local police to hold people who are undocumented, but that happens on local dime with local effort, and it ruins the connection between local police and the community. They're seen as ICE agents. So this piece of legislation has been worked on. In order to get it through the committees, we had to be strategic. We had to target the people who were on the committees and make them understand why this is important, and brought people who were undocumented, who told their stories, to really see how this works and affects real people, not just a theory that's nameless and faceless. The people together at my home congregation, Northborough, met with Representative Naughton, who was one of the committee chairs, and the people in Sharon met with Senator Timolte, who was the other chair, and advocated to have this bill leave this Joint Committee on Public Safety and Homeland Security with a favorable vote. That's strategic. That's how these things happen, rather than like a statewide letter-writing campaign. Working constituents speaking to their elected officials has a much greater impact. Working for change can be long, and the road is often hard and full of obstacles and disappointments. It's easy to lose hope. These legislative cycles, it very rarely passes the first time. You've got to be willing to keep at it. The reading today, Lessons from Geese, also captures this spirit. I think about these words when I feel tired and burnt out. I'm comforted knowing that when I work in collaboration with others, I don't always have to be the lead goose. And that goes for you, too. The work in this congregation, there's often the same people that step forward. You can get tired after a while. To know that you can drop back and the work continues helps to foster resiliency and keep your focus and keep you working for justice. Just as the geese give each other strength, we too give each other strength, and we inspire each other. The word inspire comes from to actually breathe in the spirit of another. There are many stories of people who have inspired others. One that comes to mind that really stands out for me that is very well known is the story of Jesus and the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes. It's a perfect example of the spirit of generosity, how that has an impact on creating community, like the story we heard today with Stone Soup, how it can bring people together. That story of the loaves and the fishes is sometimes told as if Jesus had magical powers. And this does him a disservice and distances him from us, as well as obscures the story's meaning. Jesus was not a magician. The people who came to hear him speak that day had to have brought food with them. And when it was time to have a meal, the people were inspired to share what they had with one another, like the village coming together and sharing the soup. They could have hid their food, thinking that they didn't have enough for anybody else. If they acted this way, they would be acting out of fear and would have remained isolated from one another. Instead, they shared what they had. And not only did everyone have more than enough, there was a significant amount of food left over. This applies to justice work as well. When we get tired or feel like we can't join a particular issue because there's just not one more thing you can take on, how do we come together as a community and share that burden? It's important in that model we care for each other so that people don't get burnt out and feel they have to walk away. In the hardest times of my life, I've been cared for through the kindness of others. Doors were opened for me and not closed. It's good to be the recipient of generosity at times because it teaches us not to be afraid when it's our turn to meet the needs of others. We know when asked for help, and we're not afraid to give of our best selves when we're called to do so by others. Change starts when one person sees something that's not right and wants to do something about it. When that person joins with another and another, then a shared vision of compassion and justice is created, and the impossible becomes possible. This is the world I choose to live in, one of hope and compassion and justice. The Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh teaches us to choose which seed we will water. The seed of hopelessness, fear, and despair, or the seed of compassion and love and hopefulness. It is said that the world gives us poison ivy and strawberries, and we are to choose which one we wish to cultivate. I choose to cultivate the strawberries and to open the granaries. And my wish for you is that you will want to do the same. Blessed be.